You think we're it? Were you bringing up the rear out there of the gang?
I don't know. There was another fellow that was waiting after me. So.
You are clearly the brave ones to take the distance coming over, and at the break time, it's a little more if you want to do the break. Let's look at the white handout, and we'll see our overview on time, just so you can know what we're up to. I just took the breakdown from the famous program, really nice program this year. And we break this down into seven. We've got between now and 11:45, so they give us 2 hours. So I broke it into seven parts. Hopefully that'll keep us moving along as we go along. And each one, watch that first step there. Each one 15 minutes. So let's call this introduction. Then we'll look at some important biblical texts for a few minutes. And then we'll look at some artifacts before the break. And your break is at 10:30, right? So we'll Simonize our watches. Okay, so 10:30 we'll break. You have a half an hour break. I mean, you could go take a nap if you want to. But the serious break is over on the front porch of the PW building, Phillips Welshemer building, where they have tea, coffee, and water you saw yesterday. They used to give you cookies, but people abused that and ate too many, and then it ruined their lunch, so they cut the cookies out altogether. And so I think it's just all liquid diet.
Serve cookies for lunch.
Yeah. I know I saw a lot of cookies at lunchtime, but it's all liquid for the break. The restrooms also are down here on the left. On both floors, you have a set of restrooms down here on the left for that break. And there's also a water fountain there if you want to just hang around here. Then we'll come back and we'll see a little bit of a film, video clip. I think it's 7 or 8 minutes on a very important artifact. And then we'll take a little bit and I'll show you one of the case studies off of our CARAC project website. And you can... get a sample of that. We'll talk about pottery there. And then I have a scavenger hunt that I'll let you go on. And that's the white sheet. Go ahead and look at the white sheet. Does somebody get in without a handout?
Yeah.
Look at the white sheet. We'll just run over this quickly. This is just for fun. If you want to do that in the time I give you at the end for a few minutes to get started, there you are. Or if you want to come back and do it again, or not at all, obviously, this is so much fun for you to choose what you want to do. But what we did is we've got stuff probably for about 8 of these cases, but we only have 4. But I think we would still have enough material for another 4, but we don't have any place to put them and don't have any more of the cases. But we lettered the cases the way we read. You know, the other wing is just like this wing. This building shoots out like this, so we're in the right wing. The left wing over on the far side is where case A and B are. And then over here you have C, down here you passed it. And then this is D right outside our door. So that's where the scavenger hunt is, in those 4 cases. And if it rains, they say today is supposed to be mid-70s and sunny. And just a teeny tiny chance of rain. And tomorrow probably about the same. So it looks like you're high and dry for the week. But at any rate, if you want to do that sometime, again, you can pursue that in the cases. We've made sure, for people like Phil Nine, we've made sure the cases are locked so that the material tends to stay there. But I hope that you'll take a few minutes and look at that.
You might take some of us as
profits. That's right. I wouldn't be surprised to find some of us in the case before it's over. I'm feeling that way myself. My back has been out of whack since last Tuesday. We've been doing a whole lot of driving, and I finally got to the doctor, and he gave me 3 things, and it makes my mouth so dry like cotton. I already needed a drink of water. I should have brought a drink down here, but I'll slip out and get a drink in a minute. But at any rate, you're where you want to be, right? We're talking about artifacts and archaeology. Does that sound like what you wanted to do? Okay, good. Good. He's going to go out and rob the cases while we're in here. And I hope you're getting enough food. They try not to skimp on that. I had the chicken and potatoes and vegetables that first night. Pam brought a carry-out styrofoam home to me, and that chicken was good, really spicy. I like that. But anyway, I hope you're not starving and that you're sleeping and all that. Sometimes you all complain about how thin the walls are in the dorms, that you can hear people snoring through the walls and that kind of thing. Others of you have told me over the years, I've been doing this 20 or more years with you all, and some of you say, no, the dorms are, you know, really nice. I don't hear a thing. So it varies, and, you know, you can
know what it is.
All kinds of ambient background noise, if you want to introduce that, yeah.
Most of the men are deaf and the women are hearing.
There it is. So, and, you know, all the strange people walking around. Do something for me. What do I do with that? My parents are 92 years old, and 6 weeks ago we moved them to an assisted living place. They had been living in the same house for the last 35 years. But they would not move here. They would not move to Florida, where my other two brothers live, have retired to Florida. And so they're Louisvillians. They're not going to budge. And so they're living in a really nice place, just literally 5 miles on the same highway from where they used to live. I won't sign you up for dance lessons. I'll send it to them. Just say, hi, hope everything's okay, or greetings, and your name, just your first name, you know, Bill and Sally, whatever. I try to send them a piece of mail every day. I send them a first-class piece of mail every day. And Dad complains that he doesn't get mail on Sunday. So, you know, some of you just cannot be pleased, you know. But anyway, it's called a place called Atria. So they're not as happy, let's say, as they were in the house. But all of us think that because Dad can't drive. And so at any rate, just a simple greeting. As I say, I try to. Today we put two Quaker oatmeal bars in a little padded envelope and sent them. They're really good with cold milk. And Pam said Jerry really likes this with cold milk. And he thought so. Just silly things like that. But this will be something different. Okay, so 10:30 will be the break. Then we come back from 11 to 11:30, and then I'll turn you loose for the scavenger hunt at 11:30. So at that point, you can either do 10, 15 minutes of scavenger hunt, or you can go ahead and beat the Baptists, you know, to the food line, because it's you know, like you do at church at home. And if there are any Baptists in here, I hate to tell you, but that's what we're doing most of the time. But the food is, of course, a little further away. Up the hill. Do you like the new dining place, those of you who've been before?
Yes.
You're like the students, though, those who are first-timers. They don't know the difference, and they just take it for granted. And, it's always been like this. No, it wasn't always like that. And one of our veterans of many years, one of your colleagues, yesterday, Charles, told me, he said, well, we like it, but you have to walk so far to get anything. And I said, yeah, you know, they're thinking of having a shuttle bus go across the across the dining hall. So, you know, it does have its disadvantages. So, at any rate, let's pray as we start. Now I think we're all here, and then we'll jump into our material. And I hope what we do will be of interest to you, and that you'll do something with this, that you'll follow up on this in some way, and I'll give you hints as to how you might do that as well. Lord, thank you for the promise of the beautiful day, of our blessings already. And especially thank you for life and health and for the opportunity to consider your word and the world in which you delivered your message first. And we thank you for the gospel that's come down to us, for the blessings we have because of what you've done through Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen. Well, so we've done the introduction. Let's do Roman numeral 2, all right? And I just call it some important biblical texts. And so, again, I sit down. And I do these kinds of things. I just sit there and I think, now what would be representative? Believe me, you could take your Bible concordance and look up the word lamp. You know, like a pottery lamp, like in these cases out here. That's case D. And one of the guys yesterday said he was going to go switch the labels around. And another Phil 9 kind of activity, it sounded like to me. But leave those tags alone. But like the word lamp, and you could spend all day looking at biblical references to lamp or sword. I mean, all these kinds of artifacts. Artifacts defined simply as things that people have made. Let me just begin by showing you this neat one right off. Got it at Lazarus. No, that's just a little, box. This is one of the first arrowheads I ever found. One of the very first ones. And I was hunting. I'm not a big hunter, but I was hunting with my dad and brother. They took me one time near Fort Knox. That's Hardin County, is the H on there. I always put a county symbol on there. Back when I was a kid, we'd collect arrowheads. And we were squatting down, just waiting. And I looked down, and there was an arrowhead right in front of me. It wasn't even broken ground. I mean, it wasn't a plowed field. There it was. And I had already started collecting arrowheads. You know, we were 14, 15. And I came back and I looked everywhere around this place and never found another piece of anything. So there must have been just some Indian hunting, you know, right in the same area where we were. But this is the kind of thing that got me interested, collecting these and other kinds of artifacts associated with, you know, the early Americans, the indigenous population. And then when I went to college and began studying the Bible closely, historically, technically, we'll say, I also began to realize you can study the biblical world, the ancient world of the Bible, and so then began to think about that. So that's the kind of stuff that gets you going in this direction. And as we were talking about it a minute ago, I've been here now. We moved here 30 years ago this summer, and so we've been here off and on 30 years. And I've worked on 13 archaeology projects in Jordan and Israel and Greece. So it kind of stuck, you know, through the years, and even teach things related to that sometimes. On your sheet, I just listed some representative passages. We're not going to look at all of them. Let me just mention the first two, for example. Judges 9. In Judges 9, there is a story about a battle that takes place at a place called Thebez, and a man by the name of Abimelech has his forces surrounding this town and the tower in the center. You know, they would retreat to the tower like a castle in later history. And you read there in Judges that a woman dropped an upper millstone on Abimelech's head, 30, 40 feet. And the old King James Version says it break his skull. And certainly would do it. I won't pass this one around because it's coming apart. This is from the southern coastal plain of Israel. But this is the kind of thing you're talking about. A millstone, an upper millstone. And they would rub this stone against stone. You've seen pictures of this. You know, like a saddle kern, they call the lower stone. And you put your wheat or barley. You'll see that displayed over in case A, where you can see that. But this is coming apart because it's just sort of petrified beach material. But let you pass this one around. This is just a fragment of one from Jordan, so it's much easier to handle. Just, you don't want to drop it either on the floor or your toe. This one's not made out of this material like petrified beach. They would be eating a lot of that. This is made out of lava, basalt. And they loved this kind of material. They would go way out of their way in ancient times to use this material. Even if they had no volcanoes near where they lived, they would haul it in on donkeys. Because when this lava cooled, the little air bubbles would pop. And so you'll have a surface with little circles. And those circles have sharp edges. And so when they would grind, those edges would help cut, break up, begin the pulverizing of the wheat and barley. So they always use this kind of vesicular basalt, little vessels, vesicular basalt. They love this kind of material. If they had to, they'd use that stuff. This is what they preferred. Now imagine this is about a third of the original. So it would have come over to here, would have come over to here, and it probably was this thick originally. It's worn down by abrasion, stone against stone. Every day you would have heard that grinding sound as you're making grain. So a typical kind of stone, just again, pass with care. Think of the muscles you would build handling something like this. And they get much, much bigger than this, too. Yes. Yes, ma'am. There was a hand up back there. Did that answer? Yeah, I saw you, and I was just trying to finish that, close my cotton mouth.
Yeah, I was just So, tons of that basalt out there in the desert in Arizona.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, there's basalt all over the world, wherever they're volcanoes. All of Hawaii is made out of basalt, you know, with a little sand on top of it. The black sand of the beaches is just pulverized basalt. So, can you imagine getting hit in the head with something like that, drop from 30, 40 feet? That would do the job. So that's just an example of an artifact. The second passage, 1 Samuel, talks about the Philistines' use of metals. That's case letter C. Display case C is all about ancient metals down the hall when you do your scavenger hunt. But 1 Samuel 13 mentions these kinds of artifacts that the Israelites had. Swords, spears, plowshares, mattocks, you know, garden tools, we'll call them, axes and goads. Not goats, but G-O-A-D. And so these are all metal implements, copper or iron. And again, there's a whole list, in other words, in that 1 Samuel 13 passage that lists a number of different kinds of artifacts. Now the next passage, though, I want to show you, I love this one. Look at this passage. Here it is projected. This is Job chapter 4, and I have marked verses 17 through 21. Watch for the references here to artifacts of a different kind. But again, this is the way archaeology's done. Here, Eliphaz, this is one of Job's dialogue partners. Remember, Job has conversation with four of his colleagues. They're accusing him of doing something evil. That's why God's punishing him. And Job claims he's innocent. But here Eliphaz is telling him, "Who do you think you are? You think you're as good as God? Why are you questioning God?" You know, something to that effect. Here's what he says down in verse 17. This is Job 4:17. It's the third text listed on your sheet. "Can a mortal be more righteous than God? If God places no trust in his servants, can a man be more pure than his maker? If God places no trust in his servants, if he charges angels with error, how much more those who live in houses of clay whose foundations are in the dust?" So in other words, if God can't trust angels, like Satan, for example, then how much lower are human beings? Well, I'll tell you how low human beings are. They live in houses made out of clay. And the foundations of their houses are in the dust. Have you seen any pictures back from Iraq lately? The dust storms have started, and you know, the troops are there, and they're all wearing camouflage, light brown, for a reason. This was because people made houses out of stone and mud brick. Mud brick was the common, cheap building material. So here we're talking about architecture as an artifact. I love this passage. People who live in houses of clay, their foundations are in the dust. They're crushed more readily than a moth. You know how fragile a moth is? You just touch it. Between dawn and dusk, they're broken to pieces, like pottery. Pottery is the most abundant archaeological artifact because it was made in such quantity and it was so easily broken and so cheaply easily replaced. The life span of a piece of pottery was a couple of months, a year, who knows. But, I mean, they just constantly were replacing it. So even on our project in Jordan, we're dealing with over 23,000 pieces of pottery just on our little project. This project that the University of Tennessee is doing is working with hundreds of thousands of pieces of pottery. I mean, again, pottery was just so abundant. Between dawn and dusk, they're broken to pieces unnoticed. They perish forever. Eliphaz is talking about us. He's talking about our lives, our human lives. Are not the cords of their tent pulled up so that they die without wisdom? There he's talking about the nomadic lifestyle, you know, where you pitch tents and stay a while and then move on. That's the nature of life. We pitch tents and we move on. Even John, in the first chapter of the Gospel of John, in John 1:14, one of the most important passages of Scripture, let me get these out of your way. John says, "The Word became flesh." Jesus became flesh and dwelt among us. The word dwelt means pitched his tent. So, in other words, Jesus, the incarnation of God and Jesus of Nazareth, was just temporary. The Word became flesh and pitched His tent among us. And so we too are like this. A fabulous passage, a beautiful passage to describe human mortality, how fragile we are. But notice the references to artifacts. Everybody would have understood what this meant because they lived in houses made of clay. And they knew broken pottery in the alleys and on the streets and in the dumps on the edge of town. And then there's Proverbs 11:1. I want to look at this one too. I love this one, and I have a great artifact to show you. I'm integrating some of the artifacts in here, and then we'll look at some of the artifacts separately in just a minute after we finish. I love this one. Also, it has a parallel in Proverbs 12:22, but it's the 11th chapter of Proverbs, verse number 1 that we're looking at here. The Lord abhors, this is the NIV translation, the Lord abhors dishonest scales, but accurate weights are His delight. Think about if they just alter the metric arrangement, you know, the meter on the gas tanks, you know, and they don't give you quite a gallon, you know, or at Kroger, they've got the scale, you know, in the meat department, just adjust a little bit, so just a fraction of an ounce, but after a while it adds up. But God delights in honest scales. You know, this is maybe from 900 B.C., and what's the organization, Weights and Measures, that goes around and checks the gas stations and checks the scales and all that? I mean, we still have this problem. Let me show you a nice weight, and we don't pass this one around. We don't even touch this one. But you can see it nicely here on Elmo. We call this machine Elmo. Elmo. It's a small, look, can you see the octagonal shape? See it? Eight-sided. It's made out of bronze, and it's a small weight that would have been used on a balance scale, you know, with like a beam balance, you know, like this. And so on one side you would put the weight. On the other side you would put something that was rather light in weight, because this one weighs only 30 grams. So they're not measuring wheat with this. This is not for, you know, big bushel baskets. This is for something precious. Something really expensive, gold dust or semi-precious gemstones, like I'll show you in a bit, or something like that. Now, they weren't using 30 gram. They weren't using the metric system in antiquity. But guess what? 30 grams is the background of our ounces. And so our ounce weights, that comes right out of the Middle Ages and goes all the way back to the standard weight. 30 grams was a standard weight, even way back, as far back as we can go. And that'll eventually evolve into our ounce-pound system that we have in our English measuring system. So this is a nice little weight, as I said, made out of bronze. And it's pretty well preserved, a little bit corroded. We have to send this back to Jordan this summer. Now we've taken our pictures, we've drawn it, we've measured it, looked at it as closely, identified it, and so forth. So that has to go back to Jordan. We keep that in a separate box. Every artifact, let me mention, has a card so that everything we do is, we call it tagged and bagged, you know, so that everything has a paper trail, we can say. Everything is photographed in black and white. Everything's photographed in color. Everything is photographed in digital. So you have paper and images of everything. And Jordan has a thumbnail photograph of everything we have here. I owe them about 1,000 pounds of stuff I have to send back later on in July out of the 2,000 pounds or so that we brought home. Then I love this passage down in Proverbs 27. We can take a peek at that one too. Proverbs 27, 21 through 22. This is a double whammy. This one's great. Double whammy, a twofer. They call this a twofer, don't they? We get two completely different kinds of artifacts. My point is here, I hope you're getting this, there are artifacts everywhere in the Bible. Everywhere. Tools, weapons, pottery, glass, jewelry. Just unimaginable how much stuff there is in there. because they had to live a life like we do. And people asked then, you know, what kind of stuff do you find in the ground? In ancient times, biblical times, they had everything we have except Tupperware. They didn't have any Tupperware. And they didn't have anything associated with, you know, motors, gasoline, electricity, nuclear power. I mean, but the technology, apart from the technology, they had to have bowls and spoons and clothing and buttons, or the equivalents of buttons, and tools and weapons and things for horses and belt buckle. I mean, they had everything except Tupperware, you know. And so, you know, that's what you find in the ground. And you can find that stuff in the ground. It can survive. All that stuff can survive in the ground, depending on the ground chemistry, the conditions in the ground, depending on moisture and the actual chemistry of composition of the soil and the physical treatment that it's received through the years. You know, if it's been crushed, you know, by earthquake, collapsed wall, that's a different story. Look at this, for example. This is from Proverbs. The crucible for silver and the furnace for gold, but man is tested by the praises he receives. So you test a person's character by how they deal with praise or compliments. Just like you test and refine silver with a crucible. And I love crucibles. I collect crucibles. I don't know why that's always fascinating. I collect everything, first of all. But crucibles I have. But you use a crucible for silver, the furnace for gold. You know, heat the ore up to high temperature, the liquid metal runs off. And then look at the second one. This is display case A again, right? Oh, silver, there's some silver in C. It's a piece of silver ore in C, case C. This is all on your scavenger hunt, though. Questions about these things. Number 22, verse 22, though you grind a fool in a mortar, again, that's your lower millstone, you know, the saddle part where you're grinding. Though you grind a fool in a mortar, grinding him like grain with a pestle, that's your upper grinding stone, comes in various shapes and you handle them differently, you will not remove his folly from him. That's great. What's that mean? What's that mean? You can grind a fool in a mortar, but in the end you still got a fool. I mean, that's how deep folly or foolishness is in some people. You can put them in a basalt grinder and grind them, and when you're finished, you know, they're still a monkey. So, you know, you've got that kind of thing going on. Oh, there's a great list of jewelry in Isaiah 3. The longest list of jewelry. I mean, talk about artifacts. I brought one piece of jewelry. I forgot. And, well, we can pass this one around. We can pass this one around. Just don't drop it. Don't bounce it off the ceiling. This is from biblical times. This is a carnelian bead. You can see the facets, eight-sided by coincidence again. And it's been worked down. And you can see the hole bored through the center. So imagine a whole string of these around someone's neck. This is made out of, make sure the little baggie stays sealed. This is made out of carnelian, or cornelian. Sometimes you see it spelled with an O, which is a semi-precious gemstone. So it's not ruby or sapphire or emerald, but it's what you call semi-precious. It's not precious, extremely valuable, but it's semi-precious. It means rare and expensive. And, you know, it's a form of quartz. And the color is because of chemical contamination, chemical components, so you get different colors. And so, again, this is the kind of jewelry. People would have had, of course, gold and silver and things like that as well. But this is a nice little bead as an example of all the jewelry that you have listed there in Isaiah. Then Isaiah 17:1, that's our next one. Isaiah 17:1, you see it on your white sheet. Isaiah 17:1 is Isaiah the prophet's condemnation of Syria. S-Y-R-I-A. Isaiah's condemnation of ancient Syria, whose capital city was Damascus. I have a friend who is going to Damascus tomorrow to take a group of graduate students. And Damascus is still a big, important city, but it's had its history in the past when it was destroyed and rebuilt and destroyed. So anywhere you dig in Damascus, you're going to find ruins. all the way back into the third millennium B.C. So Damascus has a tremendous history. But in Isaiah 17, the prophet Isaiah, or I'm sorry, that was our 17, the passage of Isaiah 17:1, the one that had the asterisk, the three little asterisks, that says that God is going to take the great city of Damascus and turn it into a heap of ruins. Some translations say a ruinous heap. You can take a city and turn it into a heap of ruins. Artifacts, right? Just think of all the artifacts you're talking about there. Artifacts. Don't think of it as a pile of ruins. Think of it as artifacts. Linda Reed calls, when we go to archaeological sites, Linda Reed says, "This looks like a pile of rocks to me." You know, I said, "Linda, get out of here." You know, yeah. You know, she has no imagination. I interrupted somebody. Nothing. So, a heap of ruins. So again, artifacts everywhere. So when these cities are destroyed, they're covering all these artifacts. And again, the archaeology goes in there and investigates this. Isaiah 37, I'm trying to get ahead of myself. Isaiah 37 I put on here because it mentions arrows that the Assyrians would use in their attack on Israel. There's an arrow in KC. You'll see it, an iron arrowhead from the Iron Age, from the time of Isaiah. And then Ezekiel 27 is just a list of trade goods. It's incredible. If you look at this list of trade goods in Ezekiel 27, you'll see all the things the ancient people traded in luxury products. Ivory, precious metals, textiles, precious woods, finished products that were imported, you know, at great distance. The value of something is always the rarity, its material, the distance over which it's come, the skill that it took to produce it. You know, this is the value of something, like a barrel of oil. You know, right? I think somehow it's way out of proportion to the skill it took to produce it, and so on. But anyway, it's hit the all-time high. It's $130.
If you measure it in euros, it's not nearly as much.
That's right. In euros, you're practically giving it away. And euros are pounds. So you guys probably are going to have to stay here. You know, we won't be able to afford the gas to get home. And then in Matthew 26, reference to the woman who has an alabaster jar of the text in Matthew 26:7 says she has an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume. Alabaster jar. Again, alabaster was rare. It was not locally found. It had to be imported from other parts of the Near East. It was beautiful when crafted into various shapes of vessels, and they used it just for precious substances. We found one nice piece of alabaster in our excavation. And then Revelation 18 has a list of trade products, not unlike what you have in Ezekiel 27, except Revelation 18 is New Testament times. So if you want to see what luxury goods were being traded in Old Testament times, you go to Ezekiel 27, a great long list of all the things that they transported on ships, especially long distance. Think things coming to the Levant, things coming to the Eastern Mediterranean, to Syria, Palestine, to Egypt, things coming to that part of the world from India, from China, from Afghanistan, from Iran, either by ship or long-distance caravans. You've heard the term, the Silk Road. You know, and that goes way back. We have a record of the Silk Road routes. Actually, a whole cluster of routes that were followed. Sometimes it would take a couple of years for the products to come from the Far East to Rome. By the time that stuff got to Rome, you think how valuable it was in the eyes of the Romans. And the Romans, of course, had all the money because of their empire to buy this stuff. They imported all these luxury products. That's in Revelation 18. Let me just mention that the last thing mentioned in Revelation 18, everything else is an artifact. Some product or some object, chariots, horses, things made out of gold, things made out of wood, you know, skilled craftsmanship. The last thing mentioned, slaves. Human souls. people were commodities too. Again, different kinds. They weren't artifacts, but they were treated, you know, like purchasable, buyable, saleable property. As you know, that went on up into even recent history. So those are some biblical passages. Let me just pass a few things that we haven't gotten to yet. Oh, I also brought a couple of other tags just to show you. Everything, as I said, is tagged and bagged. Here's an identification tag for an object. So every object is tagged and bagged. Every piece of pottery is tagged and bagged. Everything's color-coded, too. All the different types of tags, color-coded, as well as dated, marked. Who found it, when, where, what, all of that. So, again, archaeology is largely bookkeeping, record-keeping. And, yes, the artifacts are delicate. And you remove the material slowly. And so you might use a pick or a shovel, you know, at the upper level when you're going on the first part of the project. But after a while, this becomes the standard tool. It's a special kind of a trowel. You wouldn't want to use it in the garden because it's not very big. But this is a Marshalltown trowel. This is the standard tool, archaeology. It's made out of a single piece. And the nice handle, they sell these by the box load to archaeology projects. You know, when you go, we have to buy 30, 40 of these. They tend to disappear on an archaeology project for various reasons. But it's handy to carry it in your pocket, you know, and you're constantly using it. They hardly ever break. But the local people like them, and so they tend to disappear. The blades can be sharpened because you're moving through hard and compacted soil, so you have to constantly keep them sharp. But you'll see in the archaeology movies and things, you'll see that. Sometimes even down to brushes and toothbrushes, depending on, you know, if you're doing human skeleton or something fragile, you know, you have to work with tools that are a little more. In theory, that'll get back around over here to the nines, and we'll see. Then I'll pass a few other things. How about this? Do a couple of pieces of pottery. Big storage jar. Look, it's about half of the rim. And you can see whole vessels out in the cases, but obviously we're not going to pass those around. So you can see them. They're out in this case and some in the other cases. But make the rim about this big. The jar would have stood maybe this high. Shoulder coming down like this. Big storage jar for oil, olive oil, or perhaps wine, or even grain, or olives, figs, dates. Whatever they wanted to store, transport, then they would put a skin seal and then a cord would seal it, or sometimes even a pottery lid, and then solder it with clay so the rats couldn't get in it. So they want to keep bugs and rodents out of these store jars. But again, you can kind of get an idea of the weight of these things loaded down. And then here's a nice base of a pot that probably came up something like this. But look at this. This one's nice. And look at it when it comes around. Look what you can see. Can you see the potter's wheel at work? See the nice concentric circles? That's the potter's wheel. That's the way it's being formed as he's pumping that, spinning that on a wheel. So again, the telltale marks of human manufacture. That's what an artifact is. And I show that one because following right behind it is really nice little thin piece, a little bitty platter. This is Nabataean pottery. This comes from Petra in southern Jordan, where the Nabataeans, the ancient Arab people called the Nabataeans. Look at this. They call this eggshell pottery. How fragile it is. I know what it'll take. I didn't break it. But, you know, you find this everywhere. And compare this with this big clunky stuff from other periods. But just imagine a plate, nice plate like that. And then how about this? Can you make out what this one is? Again, I just brought a nice fragment of one. Clearly has a shape, doesn't it? Tablet? No. That's a good guess, though. And there are tablets in case B. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, it's a roof tile. It's a roof tile. Imagine my piece of paper is the whole piece, the whole tile, and there's where it fits. And it's a Roman roof tile. From the 3rd, 4th centuries on, they made tiles out of clay. And they would simply take the roof tiles on the roof, you know, with a pitched roof, and overlap them like this. They would overlay like this so that the water would just run off of them like this. And this heavy ceramic roof tile would provide a lot of insulation for the house. So again, these are found on Roman sites. You find these, and in Greece too. Last summer we were stumbling, and you find them by the millions. They just produced roof tiles, of course, literally by the millions, because every significant building, you know, there would be some thatch roofs, obviously. Like when Jesus was in the house there in Capernaum and they lowered the man through the roof, they weren't cutting through roof tiles, they were just cutting through mud and thatch there. You made a mess inside and had to get the sweeper out afterwards and clean it up. But it didn't take off roof tiles, in other words, is the point.
Find them in Miami Beach, too.
Yeah. You find them anywhere, again, the Southwest, anywhere where there's a lot of clay, a lot of sun, and not as much rain. Like the Middle East. Yes, ma'am.
Do you have an age of these artifacts right here?
Oh, sure. Everything is datable roughly. Right. This Nabataean pottery is 1st century B.C., 1st century A.D., you can get closer if you find an association with coins or inscriptions or something like that. And then how about this? This is kind of neat. Somebody yesterday guessed a dice. That would be, a singular. It was called a die. Isn't that right? Dice and die. So you get two of these. Some of you guys who were in the war, you'll remember that, I'm sure. My dad was in the Marines, and I think he knows something about that. What is it? Not a dice. It's not a die. Any idea before we take our break? Let's get a nice picture of one. Let's say you're making a mosaic tile floor and you need hundreds of thousands of pieces of these. These are tesserae. They call these tesserae. This is a tessera. This is like a little piece of a tile floor, even in your bathroom, where you do the grout and all that. And so the mosaic experts would come in and they would lay out a design. This map is part of the Modibo mosaic map, and it covered an area as big as this room. And I think there were 1.2 million of these used in that. And that's not painted. They use different color stones. It's not paint. So it's limestone, just with different colors because of the components of the limestone. And so they have to stand around somebody, chip, talk about a tedious job producing these things. But these are, and whenever you find that, that's a clue that you're at a Roman or a Byzantine site. Because mosaics were not used until the Roman period or the early Christian or Byzantine period. And then it continued on into Islamic times and on up to our bathrooms today. And then last, and we'll keep this one in the bag just because it's marked so well, this is a sling stone. This would not be like David and Goliath. He used pebbles, local ammunition. This is the kind professionals would carry. And we actually have pictures of Assyrians going into battle, slinging like this, carrying bags of these with them, carrying their ammo with them. Then after the battle, they'd go around and pick up the stray ammo on the field like they did, George Washington did, cannonballs against some of our British ancestors. But this is nice. Imagine getting hit in the head with one of these, even with a helmet on. This is made out of chert. This is a flint or chert nodule. And they just roughly hammer it to give it a round shape. So that's a typical sling stone. That's the typical size, the typical weight. Again, these would have been, and you find these in cities in stacks. On the wall, they have mounds of them because they want to just be able to constantly fire. So you find stacks of these inside towns of the city walls. Okay, it's officially time for your break. You have a half an hour, okay? Okay, you all are on Roman numeral 5. You had your break. You found your way back. I see we lost a few. Looks like we lost a few during the break. They're coming.
We're coming. They're out there at the display case.
No, we thought that you had abandoned ship deliberately. One of your colleagues did discover a simple factual mistake on our scavenger hunt. On the bottom here, Gene from Chatsworth discovered this mistake. Where is that, Gene? It was on display case D.
Number 11.
It's just, I could attribute it to simple vision problems, but it's probably just thinking what I wanted it to be. D11, how do you explain the crack that's developing in lamp number, it should say lamp B? It's a B instead of a 3. And I could see how that could be frustrating for people, so I'll get rid of this, and for what difference it makes. But she figured out what it was anyway, and but not everybody's going to be as sharp as greater Chattanooga people there. Okay? Thank you very much. So let's just say a word about Caiaphas. Now, this is an artifact. I mean, there are artifacts and there are artifacts. Okay? Phil was talking about the Taj Mahal, again, versus foundations in the dust. I mean, there are buildings and then there are buildings. There's this building versus, the old original Johnson Bible College buildings. I mean, artifacts vary and architecture varies. So we could talk about this one as a whole workshop. Let's just say a word about it, and then I want to show you a little bit of a film clip from the Biblical Archaeology Society with a guy named Herschel Shanks, who's the editor of this magazine. An ossuary is a bone box that you put human bones in what they call secondary burial. The bone box is typically about 2 feet long, about a foot wide, and about a foot and a half tall, something like that. Some of them are smaller if it's for an infant. Some of them are larger if there are multiple skeletons in the box. But it's a box that holds skeletons after the flesh is all decomposed, and they come in and take the skeleton apart and put it in the box. So the box only has to be as big as the femur bone, the long bone in your leg. It has to hold the skull, too. For example, this one, he either had 5 or 6 individuals in one box. So they would put families together in boxes. And, the idea is a family that's put in a bone box together stays together. Probably reflects belief in resurrection. We guess that this is what it's about. We'll talk about all these things. Again, I spent a couple of days in class on this, I try to get the basis, but I'm trying to squeeze this in for you all. But it's probably the Jewish practice of resurrection that we're looking at. What's interesting is this all fits in a very narrow window. They know about 1,500 ossuaries from excavations, and there are thousands of them, that are known otherwise. But about 1,500 have been excavated, so we know exactly their origin. They came right out of the ground from the moment of their discovery. Most of them from the Jerusalem area. So this seems to be around Jerusalem. If it's associated with resurrection, and there are whole books on this, whole dissertations on this, in the Vatican, people study this. There are a lot of people who believe that in Jerusalem you had this very strong belief in resurrection, Orthodox Judaism, the Pharisees. It's also a pretty narrow window in time. It's something like 100 B.C. up into maybe the 2nd century A.D. So there seemed to be a strong correlation with Jerusalem and a certain time period. Other suggestions is that it's just a way to show respect for the dead. So you, after the body decomposes, you put it in the, in the bone box. Let me show you, for example, this is the bone box, and then I'll show you the clip. This is the one we're going to focus on. I'm sorry, yes. About 2 feet by a foot by a foot and a half.
Made out of clay?
Solid limestone, block of limestone, carved out the bottom, and then the top would be a separate piece. Good question.
Well, yeah, there's
spell
what you said.
Ossuary. O-S-S-U-A-R-Y. It's Latin for bone. O-S-S-U-A-R-Y. That's why we just call it a bone box. Okay? Now again, the movie's going to go into all this, so hang on here. The movie's going to go into it. That's why I'm showing you the movie. I'm trying to mention a couple things that are not in the movie. Let me show you a good illustration of where this is a well-known complex tomb that has this. Yeah, this is a place on the Mount of Olives. Ossuaries came out of this. Here's a nice example of what the tomb would have looked like. You go into a cave, the tomb, and they have these little niches. And the film will mention this. These little niches off the side. And you would put the corpse in one of these niches. And then after it decomposes a year, 2 years, whenever they want that niche again for a fresh cadaver, they would pull out the skeletal remains, put them in the bone box, and then just stack, sometimes they just stack the bone boxes up, you know, out in the center of the tomb, just like cordwood. I mean, literally crisscrossing, two, like this. And so the bone boxes would just be stacked out here. And then they would seal this with stone and plaster, so they'd be sealed up, again, keeping burrowing animals out. And you can see this tomb is damaged either from robbers or just from roof collapse. And burrowing animals get into tombs a lot, scavengers. So you have to be careful about that. So let me show you the movie, and then we'll see what questions remain after that. See if I can get the movie. As I said, it's only about 6 or 7 minutes. Help me get the volume if it's...
The High Priest Caiaphas. According to the Gospels, Caiaphas presided.
I'll take it back just a little bit. Here's what makes this so spectacular, is that it is a bone box associated with the high priest Caiaphas. And I've given you the Caiaphas references.
This is the ossuary, or bone box, of the high priest Caiaphas.
Is the volume good?
According to the Gospels, Caiaphas presided at the trial of Jesus. We can thank an unusual and relatively short-lived burial custom for this ossuary. From about 30 BCE to 70 CE, and mostly around Jerusalem, influential and wealthy Jews practiced what scholars call ossolegium, or secondary burial. This is how it worked. Tomb caves were cut into the soft limestone in the hills around the city. Some of the entrances were quite elaborate, like this one. Inside, and here we are inside the Caiaphas family tomb, long holes or cavities were cut into the rock, long enough to hold a body. These holes are called kochim in Hebrew and loculi in English. The body of the deceased was first laid in a koch,
a niche,
or loculus.
A niche.
Then, after a year when the flesh had decomposed, the bones were collected and reburied in a limestone box called an ossuary. The ossuary was then replaced in the koch, or loculus, for permanent burial. Often, more than one ossuary was put in the same loculus, and the bones of more than one person were frequently buried in the same ossuary. The purpose of this secondary burial is not quite clear. It most likely reflects a belief in physical resurrection. The bones were collected and preserved so that they would be ready for new flesh in the life to come. Several thousand ossuaries have been recovered in the Jerusalem area, but none is more beautiful than the one in this exhibit. The pattern that decorates it is both intricate and rare. Two circles are featured on the facade. Each of the circles consists of six whorl rosettes, one in the middle and five around it. A stylized branch goes up each side, continuing on the top of the ossuary and culminating in a small six-petaled center rosette, thus forming a frame for the two large circles of rosettes.
All cut in the limestone with a chisel.
The ossuary was originally painted. Orange paint has survived on some of the petals of the rosettes. On the back of the ossuary and on one of the sides, workmen scratched a name, presumably the name of the person whose bones were inside.
From right to left, it reads.
In contrast to the carefully carved facade, the inscriptions on the side and back are roughly scratched. But the names are startling. Yehoseph Bar Caipha, Joseph, son of Caiaphas. In the Gospels, the high priest who presided at the trial of Jesus is simply called Caiaphas. But the first century Jewish historian Josephus tells us that the high priest from 18 to 36 CE was Joseph, who was called Caiaphas. That is, his name was Joseph, but he was called Caiaphas. Scholars tell us that the name Caiaphas was a kind of nickname for the family passed on from generation to generation. These inscriptions, therefore, are not to be understood literally. Joseph was not the biological son of Caiaphas. He was the son of Caiaphas the way a student at Yale is a son of Eli.
Eli, yeah.
Translating less literally, the inscriptions read, Joseph of the Caiaphas family.
Right.
The script is the cursive Jewish script typical of the period. Inside the ossuary were the bones of six people, four young people, an adult woman, and a 60-year-old man. These were probably the bones of the high priest. All the bones have now been respectfully reburied on the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem. The Caiaphas ossuary was found, quite by accident, in November 1990, when some workmen were clearing ground in a Jerusalem forest for a children's water park. This is the first time it is being displayed outside of Israel. If you would like to learn more...
Okay, let me again add a couple of things. We could spend lots and lots of time on this, and there are articles and articles and articles written on this. It's a spectacular discovery, 1990. This is authentic. I mean, it came right out of the ground. It was discovered by accident when they were excavating, bulldozing for this water park, southeastern suburb of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is just like a metropolitan American city, basically. And you have suburbs and everything. And you have Toys R Us and all the chain foods and all that stuff. But there's a water park, you know, where the kids slide on the water things and all that. And this area called Abu Tor, T-O-R, they found it. I say that because there are some other controversial ossuaries. The most recent one is this one that has the name on it. The James ossuary, they call it. James, the brother of Jesus. This one's still disputed as to whether it's authentic or fraudulent. I saw it in Toronto when it was here on the continent for a display at one of the big society meetings. And again, the controversies began soon after that meeting in Toronto. The most famous ossuary ever found is one from 1967 or 68. I think 68. Another Jerusalem suburb called Givat HaMivtar, where they found an ossuary in which contents had a male skeleton, and in his heel bones driven an iron spike. So this is a victim of crucifixion. It's the only physical evidence of crucifixion. We know there were thousands of people crucified, but this is the only physical evidence of an ancient crucifixion found from Jerusalem, no less. So the Romans crucified people by the thousands. You ever see the movie Spartacus? At the end of the Spartacus Rebellion, Kirk Douglas, Tony Curtis, they crucified several thousand at one time to, you know, as an object lesson, you know, to teach them a lesson. Slave rebellion. Don't do this again or we'll crucify you by the thousands. So Jesus and the thieves on the cross, three, that was almost, you know, not even noteworthy other than the tremendous significance it holds, of course, for us and for the world. But what makes this so interesting is that this is the Caiaphas family. Caiaphas was the high priest from 18 to 36, A.D. 18 to 36. In other words, the whole adult lifetime of Jesus through the time of his death, burial, resurrection. He would have been the man presiding over the Jewish court that condemned Jesus to death. Christian tradition had, for a long time, said that the Caiaphas palace... the palace of this high priest. Remember, even his father-in-law had been high priest before that. His name is Annas, A-N-N-A-S, and he's mentioned also in the Gospels as part of the decision-making process, had influence on his son-in-law. This was a political office you held by, you know, by getting it through the Roman contacts that you had. And tradition had that the palace of Caiaphas was in this neighborhood of Abu Tor. In fact, in the Crusades, the Crusaders, think of this, the Crusaders in 1100, 1200, called this area, this neighborhood of Abu Tor, they called it the Hill of Evil Counsel, where the condemnation of Jesus was made in the decision-making body, the Sanhedrin, the Jewish elders, and so on, and the high priest. It's a remarkable thing, and then they discover this by accident. And there are actually three inscriptions in this tomb that mention the Caiaphas family name. And notice he says that the New Testament, and I've given you all the references to Caiaphas, the New Testament only calls him Caiaphas. But the Jewish historian from the first century, very, very nice source for anything like this, good reputable historian, Jewish historian named Josephus, he tells us his name was Joseph Caiaphas. And that's what the name is on one of the ossuaries, Joseph Caiaphas. And on the other two, it's just Caiaphas. It's the family, Caiaphas family. So you're looking at a complex family tomb complex here. So it's really remarkable. Again, and we're not trying to exhaust it, but just to say artifacts come in different levels. You know, as I say, look, I mean, this broken potsherd, that's an artifact. So is the Caiaphas ossuary. That's an artifact too, but that's a real artifact there, okay?
Have you found anything like that?
No, we've never found anything like that. But better stuff than that. That's a subject for another seasoned saints. Okay, the last thing I want to do, I want to get you out of here, is look for a second at the last Roman numeral. And then I'll show you something on the screen. I want you to go with me to one of our CARAC Resources Project website case studies. And I've given you the address, if you're a computer person. If you're not, you can just enjoy looking at this for a second, and then we'll go to the scavenger hunt. The VKRP, we call it, Virtual CARAC Resources Project. If you just go to Google, and you can type in VKRP, Virtual CARAC Resources Project, and it's the first thing that comes up on Google. Okay, or you can put the whole thing, Virtual CARAC Resources. This is our archaeology project's website. We've lost the little link that shows the weather in Amman, Jordan here. They must have gone offline. Anyway, there are all kinds of things here on the home page. But what you want to do when you go to Virtual CARAC Resources Project is go to the case study menu. And under this case study menu, there are four categories: archaeological, cultural, environmental, and historical. For example, under historical, look at all these case studies. And each one of these is a study on topics related to our project, all written by our team members. For example, here's one on a particular type of architecture that we have. And you can go to any of these studies and work your way through it. There'll be an outline, a bibliography, instructor helps. I use this as a textbook in one of my classes. People all over the country are using it as a textbook online. All the photos and maps in this study, related links to this study, a glossary. So, for example, if you want to see just all the photos and maps related to this, you can go and you can just flip through them and see them all at one point. Or you can go back in the study and see them where they actually belong. And then you can, of course, blow any of these things up as well, on up to full screen size. What I wanted to do is just show you, as an example, one of the case studies, the one that the guy who's going to Damascus tomorrow, in fact, by coincidence, the one that he did, and I'm going to go up. You can also choose your type of case study up here under study type. So we'll go to the one under archaeological, and let's look at pottery. What happens to pottery as it comes out of the ground, from the ground up? In other words, when you find a broken sherd or you find a whole vessel, what happens? And I'll just go right to the photos and just flip through the pictures quickly. Understand that in the study it describes all this. It has the full text. And I'm just showing you some of the pictures. So you find potsherds like this, crushed, broken. Most of these are going to be of the same vessel. And you can try to put these kinds of things together. And that's a lot of fun, like a big jigsaw puzzle. We do that as well. Sometimes the shape is a little more discernible. Like here's a jar rim. You can see this would be the upper part of a jar. You know, the sort of the spout part where you could pour. And, of course, the pottery is so important because it's datable, again, roughly datable. It's in such abundance because it was easily made, easily broken. And it also lets us know about the technology of the people, and it lets us know what kinds of things went on in particular areas. If you have nothing but big old store jars, you're in a warehouse. If you have cook pots and utensils like you'd use around an oven, you're in a kitchen. You know, so you have that kind of help that comes your way. So the pottery is carefully removed. Here's one of the guys actually dealing with some fragile stuff, and he's down to the brush level, as you can see. I recognize that shirt. This is one of our Jordanian colleagues, Muhammad Tarana, who's worked for us in the past. And then all the material is taken very carefully, isolated from the other material, from other squares that are being dug. It's taken to a sift, where everything you remove is put through a sieve to separate out the soil from the possible artifacts, and of course rocks and things like that get in there as well. Everything is shaken to allow that material to pass through, sifted. You eventually get down to rocks or artifacts, and here's where you're going to find pottery, beads, arrowheads, sometimes scorpions still hanging around in there. You have to be careful with that. I always use gloves when I'm sorting through this, but one of the local guys not too worried about it. But again, you can see that you're down to that point. Everything goes into its separate bucket. Every separate area you're digging has a separate sifting operation. And we have a traffic manager who makes sure that every bucket that comes off the site goes to the proper sifting processing area. So you have, you know, as many sifts operating as you are digging in places. And you have a bag that includes bones, and then the pottery goes in the bucket. Everything, again, as you know by now, everything is bagged and tagged carefully. You have a waterproof tag tied to the bucket. You have a bag that the bones go in. It also has the same information. So that when all this material is collected at the end of the workday, it all goes back to camp together on the bus. I like this one. This is Valdeci da Silva. This is one of our JBC graduates who teaches at Colegio Biblico down in Eagle Pass, Texas. Maybe you've heard of our college on the Texas-Mexican border. His son is a student at the college right now. Valdeci worked with us one summer. And all the material goes back to camp. Oh, and I should mention that every bucket that's sifted gets counted so that you know that a particular area had 200 buckets or 300 buckets or 50 buckets, so you get an idea of the volume of material that you went through in a given time period. Then you go back to camp. Everything is washed. Remember, everything is kept separate. Everything is carefully washed. And it is fragile, so you don't just rub it with brushes. You look at it carefully. Then everything is put out, again, tagged and bagged, put out to dry in these fruit bags. We buy these by the thousands. We buy them in bundles in Amman. You can buy them before you go out in the country, and then you have them. They always wonder why the Americans are buying all these fruit bags, because they know that we're not raising oranges. And, you know, it's hard to explain to them what's going on. The next day, after the pottery's dried, it is red, R-E-A-D. It's looked at and examined for time periods, so you know the time period you're working through. As the summer goes on, what happens? Further into the summer, what happens to your pottery? It gets older, right? Because the basic principle, further down you go, the older the material, normally, unless some kind of inversion has taken place. And, you know, you watch for those kinds of things. This is a nice place to show the team members. Daniel Hoffman from Lee University down Chattanooga way, Cleveland, Tennessee. Ted Carruth from David Lipscomb University in Nashville. Jimmy Pace from Elon University over in North Carolina. He's the one going to Damascus tomorrow. He's the one who wrote this study. John Wineland from Kentucky Christian University. Heather McMurray. We call her Heather Mac. Heather McMurray is a graduate student at Vanderbilt. Joel Drinkard from the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville. Don Garner from Carson Newman College up the road. David Jefferson, a retired chemical engineer from Louisville. So the team's made up of different people, and again, the process is pretty careful. Dave Jefferson's so meticulous, he records everything that's going on. He's the official note keeper. Everything, again, is individually marked. Everything is individually identified, the old-fashioned way, manually. Double-check, triple-check, quadruple-check against the records. Dave Jefferson keeping those records again. It's done by computer as well, but it's also done in a paper notebook, compared, contrasted. Remember, everything is shot in black and white and color and digital. Protect it with a coat of old-fashioned fingernail polish. All the pottery is cut, sawn to give a side view, a profile, a cross section. We use nice saws for this, nice ceramic tile saws. You can even cut a handle right in half like this. You can see the content for the composition. This is technology, you know, the firing temperature. And this is useful, again, for dating purposes because of the styles changing through time. Dave Jefferson, Jim Pace, again, comparing records. All this is described in the text. Jim looking at the composition. He's one of our pottery people. And then eventually everything is drawn. Used to be by hand. Now everything is scanned in cross-section and then filled in with Adobe Photoshop. And so everything is on disk. And, you still use the old-fashioned method, but you also use the electronic means. Because a lot of the publication is even electronic. You don't even use paper for publication purposes. So again, this is just a sample of one of the case studies. Under cultural, you have some interesting case studies on Christianity in an Arab village. The Bedouin tribes, there are four studies there. We've got some other ones in process. That was cultural. Environmental, there are some really interesting studies about water and animals and soils and geology. Some interesting studies there. I think there are altogether about 36 studies. And you've seen historical study. There are lots and lots and lots of things under historical study. So, you know, when you get home, if you're interested, there is the website, www.vkrp.org, not com, but org, O-R-G. Yes?
Are there credentials for the people that go on these excavations?
You have to have credentialed people. The Jordanian government looks at all that and checks all that kind of thing. We always will take people with us. We call them engineers or real people, people who know how to do something. You know, like Wilbur Reed, for example, worked with us twice because Wilbur knows how to do everything. And, you know, we're out there, if the car breaks down, we just look at each other. We don't. Wilbur fixes it. If plumbing goes bad, we look at each other. Wilbur fixes it. If the doorknobs need to be replaced because the locks are broken, we just look at each other. Wilbur, we come back and Wilbur's changed them all with the other wing of the hotel, and the hotel doesn't even know he did it. Uh-oh. I didn't mean to record that. So there you have it. Okay, your scavenger hunt. We made the little boo-boo. But what I did is I labeled the cabinets A, B, C, D, and we gave a theme to each cabinet. A cabinet over in the other wing is food. And so I call that one, "Give us this day our daily bread." Right? You recognize that phrase out of the prayer in Matthew 6. B cabinet is what? Ancient writing, and what's our slogan for that cabinet? The paper reads, the papyrus reads. I could have put it on there, but I don't think I did. Who hid out in a papyrus thicket when he was a little boy? Yeah, Moses. So when you see the papyrus in the case, that's Egyptian Nile River papyrus. And we made, in our Egypt class, I make the students make papyrus. And boy, you talk about appreciating the ancient Egyptians. It's a messy, stinky, laborious process. And every sheet we make, we're proud of every single sheet we make. And you know, some of them are better quality than others, but it's very difficult. And so we use the same process the Egyptians. So yeah, Moses has some experience with papyrus reeds, a word from which we get our word paper. Cabinet C is metals. That's this one down here. This may be my favorite one. I like this one. It's the one right down the hall here. It was most fun putting it together. Most colorful. And our motto there is, this is my motto, "Silver and gold have I none." Remember, says Peter to the beggar. And then D is lamps and pottery. That's this one right out the hall here from Psalm 119. That word is a lamp to my feet, a light to my pathway. So, again, there you have it. If you have time sometime, I won't hope that it rains, so you come over and do it. But if it rains, come over and do it. Otherwise, I know you'll be wanting to run around and go to the outlets and all those kinds of crazy things you all do.